and has over 100 employees. Its annual budget approaches $25 million, all of which is privately funded, no government money at all. After three-quarters of the funding comes from individuals, with most of the rest coming from foundations, Cato gets only a modest support from corporate community, which evidently doesn't like its opposition to corporate welfare as well as special interest legislation. The mission of the Cato Institute is to promote free markets, private property, individual liberty, and strictly limited government. His bio mentions that he was co-counsel in the Watershed Supreme Court case, District of Columbia versus Heller. What it doesn't mention, of course, is that Bob located the plaintiffs, funded the case for years out of his own pocket, and won the case, and Bob Levy doesn't even own a gun. A clear demonstration of Bob's commitment to individual liberty and rights. The District of Columbia versus Heller also happens to be the only case in any court that he served as counsel, kind of starting at the top there. The title of Bob's talk is How the Supreme Court Has Amended the Constitution. It draws from his latest book, The Dirty Dozen. The paperback of The Dirty Dozen was just released for $10, and he'll be signing books outside the dining room after his presentation. Bob has been a frequent guest on my show. He's been a good friend, and I personally deeply admire him. Please help me welcome Bob Levy.
It's great to be with you. It's great to be with you. Are we okay on the mics now? Testing. 1, 2, 3. How's that? Is that better? Okay. It is great to be with you. I am a lawyer, and I get to tell a lawyer story. You may have heard on the internet that Al-Qaeda said they had kidnapped 100 lawyers. And he said, if the United States doesn't get out of Afghanistan within a week, they're going to begin releasing the lawyers one by one. I'm originally from D.C., but I am a fellow Neapolitan and love the city, Naples, and have developed great friendships here. In fact, I'm part of a small group of guys. They're all older than I am, but they invited me to join, and they have this tradition. Even if they don't see each other for long periods of time, they meet every 10 years to have a reunion here in Naples. And this all started when they were 40 years old. They got together and they voted and decided to go to the Ritz to have dinner because most of the waitresses there wore these low-cut blouses, you know. And 10 years later, they're 50 years old and they meet and they vote and they decided to go to the Ritz because the food and the wine is spectacular. Fast forward another decade, they're 60 years old and they meet and they decided to go to the Ritz because it's smoke-free and it's a peaceful and calm environment. And then they turn 70 in another decade, and they meet and decided to go to the Ritz because it's wheelchair accessible. And then just last week, they all turned 80 and they met and decided to go to the Ritz because they'd never been there before. Well, I'm going to talk about a few cases that I think have done a great deal of damage coming out of the Supreme Court. But before I do that, I like to set the stage by offering a background, contrasting how liberals look at the Constitution with how conservatives look at the Constitution, and comparing those two against how libertarians, such as myself and my colleagues at the Cato Institute, look at the Constitution. Now, when I talk about libertarianism, I'm not talking about the political party. I'm talking about a political philosophy that focuses on private property, free markets, individual rights, and strictly limited government. So at Cato, we don't endorse candidates. We don't endorse political parties. As you're soon going to hear, we are equally critical of both the Democrats and the Republicans, the conservatives and the liberals. We do have a consistent, I would call it minimalist view, of what is the proper role of government. So conservatives will agree with us on some issues. They tend to be domestic, regulatory, economic, fiscal issues. And liberals will agree with us on other issues. They tend to be the social issues, civil liberties issues, immigration, and a non-interventionist foreign policy. And the reason for that is that both conservatives and liberals are inconsistent. And to illustrate that, I want to offer for you a constitutional framework. I believe that the structure of our federal system, and indeed the structure of the U.S. Constitution, can best be understood by looking at the final two provisions of the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment. And for those of you who are a little bit rusty, the Tenth Amendment controls the powers of government. And what it says is that if the powers are enumerated and delegated to the federal government in the Constitution, then the federal government can exercise those powers. But the amendment goes on to say that if the powers are not enumerated and not delegated to the federal government, then they're reserved to the states, or depending on the provisions of state law, they are reserved to the people. Now, the powers we're talking about, you will find listed. The power to coin money, the power to establish post offices and postal roads, the power to regulate interstate commerce, and on and on. Conservatives and libertarians generally agree on that very tightly constrained, narrow view of federal powers, but there are a couple of key exceptions. First is that many conservatives, but not libertarians, are willing to federalize, and by that I mean assign responsibility to the federal government for a great deal of both criminal and civil law. If you want an example in the criminal law area, take a look at our futile, totally ineffective war on drugs, for which there is no constitutional authority. Criminal law is traditionally a function exercised by the state government. If you want to look at the civil law area, take a look at tort reform, and you will hear conservatives in today's environment insisting that malpractice, for example, reform be on anybody's health care bill and be enacted by Congress. Now, it may be that malpractice reform is absolutely necessary. It may be a great idea. But the question is whether it's constitutionally authorized. And the allegation from those who are proponents of malpractice reform is that it's an exercise of interstate commerce. Well, the typical malpractice case is an in-state patient suing an in-state doctor for an injury that occurred within one state. It's awful difficult to imagine how that morphs into a regulation of interstate commerce. And yet conservatives are typically willing to overlook that because they think malpractice reform is a necessary and desirable end result. Conservatives and libertarians disagree about that. The libertarians remind their conservatives friends that if that power is not enumerated, it doesn't matter if it's a good idea, it doesn't matter if conservatives think they have the answer and that Congress can enact a suitable answer. If the power is not enumerated in the Constitution, the federal government has to step aside and leave the matter up to the states. Of course, that was the intention, and it is not what has occurred over the years. Today, you will find the federal government immersed in matters, and you'll find that none of these are authorized in the Constitution, ranging from public schools to hurricane relief to welfare to retirement to medical care to family planning, even aid to the arts, not a single one of which can be found among Congress's enumerated powers. Now, there's a second area where conservatives and libertarians differ regarding powers of government, and that is that conservatives are less anxious than libertarians about concentrating an awful lot of power in the executive branch, particularly when it comes to this trade-off between civil liberties and national security. Libertarians remind their conservative friends that when you locate too much power in one branch of government, that threatens the doctrine of separation of powers. The separation of power and authority between the legislative, executive, and judicial branches that has been a cornerstone of the Constitution for more than 2.25 centuries. So the administration, and I'm sorry to say I mean most particularly the George W. Bush administration, may not by itself unilaterally set the rules, prosecute infractions, determine guilt or innocence, and then decide whether the administration has abided by the dictates of the Constitution. Setting the rules is not an executive function. It's a legislative function. And deciding whether or not the administration has complied with the rules, that is not an executive function. It's a judicial function. So that's the powers of government perspective, grounded on the Tenth Amendment and the separation of powers doctrine. Now, I mentioned another amendment, and that is the Ninth Amendment. And again, for those of you who recall, the Ninth Amendment doesn't talk about powers. It talks about rights. And what it says is that merely because there are only certain rights listed in the Constitution, that doesn't mean that those are all the rights we have. We have lots and lots of rights that existed way before the Constitution was written, indeed, way before the United States government was even formed. And that imposes yet another discipline on the federal government, because what it says is that even if the federal government exercises its legitimate powers, the powers that are limited by the 10th Amendment, the ones that are expressly enumerated, even if the federal government exercises just those powers. The 9th Amendment says you can't exercise even that limited list of powers in a manner that violates our rights. And if you want to know what rights can't be violated, says the 9th Amendment, it's not just the ones that are enumerated in the Constitution, like free speech and religion and protection against unreasonable searches. It's also unenumerated rights, rights that we had before the Constitution was written, which in the libertarian view would include, for example, the right to gamble, and indeed even the right to smoke marijuana. Now notice that the presumptions of the 9th and 10th Amendment are exactly opposite one another, and if you grasp that, I think you grasp the entire structure of the U.S. government and indeed of the federal Constitution. The 10th Amendment says if the power isn't there, the government doesn't have it. The 9th Amendment says merely because the right isn't there doesn't mean we don't have it. We have lots of rights that we had long before the U.S. government was formed. So if you wanted to identify one particular provision of the Constitution that distinguished libertarians from conservatives, it would be the 9th Amendment. Former Judge Robert Bork describes the 9th Amendment as an inkblot. Now, he is perhaps the best known of the conservative judges, and he said the 9th Amendment should be ignored. It's as if nobody knows what it means. It's as if somebody spilled ink on the portion of the 9th Amendment that would have identified these unenumerated rights that the libertarians tell us that we have. Libertarians treat the 9th Amendment as if it meant something. We argue that it refers to our natural rights, the rights that we possess by virtue of our nature as rational human beings, and that we still retain even after the Constitution was written. In short, all of the so-called negative rights. Now, negative rights sounds like a pejorative, a critical term. It's not meant to be. A negative right is a right that doesn't impose affirmative obligations on other people. Contrast that with positive rights which some people call entitlements, that do impose affirmative obligations. And to flesh that out, imagine a right to the pursuit of happiness. It's a negative right. I can pursue happiness, and I do not need your help. I simply need you to stay out of my way, don't exercise force against me, and don't exercise fraud against me. So there's no affirmative obligation imposed upon you. But suppose I had a right to happiness, not the pursuit of happiness, but the attainment, the realization, the achievement of happiness. And if I say I have a right, it presupposes I have a remedy. So if I'm not happy, I can do something about it if I have that right. Now you can imagine that that would impose affirmative obligations on each and every one of you. At a minimum, if I had an enforceable right to be happy, then you couldn't do anything that would make me the least bit unhappy, and if you did, I would be able to go to court and get redress. Now these positive rights, these are integral to the liberal view of the proper role of government. And since I've been critical of the conservatives, I want to be an equal opportunity critic. The positive rights that we're most used to dealing with and hearing about are rights to welfare, to a minimum wage, to housing, to health care, and on and on and on. Liberals ordinarily will embrace all of these big government programs, but paradoxically, in this post-9/11 environment, we are hearing from liberals who endorse big government that they have one reservation, one area of big government that they're worried about, and that is the trade-off between national security and civil liberties. Where, however, is the left on other areas where big government has taken control of our lives? Things like control of our retirement system, our welfare system, our public school system, and the private economy. Why hasn't the left's, I think, very healthy distrust of big government extended to support for privatized Social Security or school choice or the elimination of regulations that seem to control everything from the size of a navel orange to the ergonomics of office equipment? Why is it that the liberals can only pinpoint two agencies of government when they're worried about big government? All the other agencies can be as big as they want to be, but not the Defense Department and not the Justice Department. Those two agencies raise liberal concerns about the size of government, and oddly enough, those two agencies are the ones that are charged with an indisputably legitimate function of government, and that is to protect us from domestic and foreign predators. So imagine if Congress were to delegate to the Justice Department, especially if the Justice Department were still under the control of Ashcroft or Gonzalez. Suppose Congress were to delegate to the Justice Department the power to enact regulations regarding the trade-off between civil liberties and national security, and it gave the Justice Department no more guidance than keep us safe from the terrorists. People on the left would be apoplectic, and they would have every right to be apoplectic, because passing those kinds of regulations is not the function of an executive agency. But when the same Congress delegates to the Environmental Protection Agency the authority to pass regulations regarding the trade-off between economic growth and a clean environment, and gives the EPA no more guidance than keep us safe from the pollutants, folks on the left applaud enthusiastically. Now, could it be that the pollutants are a greater threat to us than terrorists? Not likely. What is more likely is that the left has a selective indignation about the proper role of government, and that reflects, I think, an inconsistency in the liberal mindset, much as there is an inconsistency in the conservative mindset about the proper role of government. And that, of course, is the foundational question. What is the proper role of government? And it's that question, when addressing that question, that the Constitution can be viewed through these two prisms. The Ninth Amendment, which is rights of individual prism, the Tenth Amendment, which is powers of government prism. The libertarian view, in a nutshell, is that the powers of government have to be interpreted very narrowly, and the rights of individuals have to be interpreted very broadly, and that, of course, was precisely the vision of the framers. So that's the background, and now I want to turn to just a handful of cases that have come out of the Supreme Court that I think have done a great deal of damage, and most important for today's discussion, they have implications for the environment in which we now are immersed. The first case, and these are in no particular order, they're not worst case, the next worst, they're just some bad cases. The first case is a case called Helbering v. Davis. Most of you who haven't been to law school, I'm sure, have never heard of these cases. This is a 1937 case, and the issue in this case was whether or not the Social Security system was constitutional. Now, in addressing that issue, you have to think like a judge. The issue is not whether Social Security is a good idea. It's not whether you like getting your check every month. It's not whether the system is actuarially sound. It is, for a judge, where in the Constitution will you find authorization for the Social Security system? And the proponents said, well, it's in the General Welfare Clause. It's the power to tax in order to provide for the general welfare. This became a battle between Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Madison. Hamilton said the General Welfare Clause provides an extra added power of Congress. We have all these powers of Congress that are listed in Article 1, Section 8. And in addition, says Hamilton, there is another power, and that is to tax in order to provide for the general welfare. Madison said that can't be the case. If the Congress had this plenary power to provide for the general welfare, that would eviscerate the whole notion of limited federal government. Everything can be couched as if it provided for the general welfare. And Madison even went a step further. He said, not only isn't the General Welfare Clause an extra added power of Congress, it is in fact a restriction on Congress. What it means, said Madison, is that when Congress exercises the powers that are enumerated, all the ones in Article 1, it has another hurdle to jump through. It can only exercise those powers in a manner that provides for the general welfare, not the welfare of what Madison called factions and what we today call the special interests. Well, the Supreme Court looked at the case and said, essentially, Mr. Hamilton wins, Mr. Madison loses, and that opened the floodgates through which the redistributive state was ready to pour, taking money from some people, giving it to other people without any constitutional constraints whatsoever. We are involved in that process as I speak. The next case, every bit as bad, 1942. Wickard v. Filburn. Now, Congress has this express power in the Constitution to regulate interstate commerce. The question in Wickard v. Filburn was, does the power to regulate interstate commerce extend to activities that are not interstate and not commerce? And if you think the answer to that is self-evidently no, you haven't been following the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Filburn, these are quite extraordinary facts. He grew wheat on his own farm just during the New Deal era and the Depression era, and he didn't buy the wheat, he grew it, and he didn't sell any wheat. He ate it all, or he gave it to his farm animals. The Roosevelt administration decided it had to regulate the production of wheat to support the price. And it told Mr. Filburn he had to curtail some of his production. And Filburn says, under what authority? And Roosevelt says, we're regulating interstate commerce. Filburn quite naturally responds, that can't be. This is not interstate. It's all on my farm within one state, and there's no commerce. I'm growing this stuff, and I'm eating everything I grew. Supreme Court said, Mr. Filburn, you just don't get it. Because after all, Filburn, if you weren't growing that stuff, you would have had to buy it. And if you didn't eat everything that you grew, you would have had some left over to sell. So by not buying and not selling, obviously you've had an impact on the supply and demand for wheat in the interstate markets. And therefore, we can regulate you, and that opened a second set of floodgates through which the regulatory state was ready to pour, regulating anything and everything under the rubric of the Commerce Clause. Wickard v. Filburn paved the way for the noxious notion that Congress can even punish the failure to purchase a product, most particularly health insurance, from a private company. And that is unprecedented. Under current law, it is even illegal to purchase health insurance across state lines, so there is no interstate market to be regulated. And moreover, if Congress can mandate the purchase of health insurance, why not the purchase of exercise equipment or a new fuel-efficient car or any number of other private products? The individual mandate would, if approved, extend the dominion of the federal government to virtually all manner of human conduct, including non-conduct, establishing a power for the federal government that is nowhere authorized in the U.S. Constitution, and that is the legacy of Wickard v. Filburn. Third case, Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell, another New Deal case, 1934. This is what the Constitution says, and listen to how crystalline this is. Quote, no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. Clear enough, not for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld a Minnesota statute that, and see if this sounds familiar, postponed mortgage payments for financially troubled homeowners. Never mind the contract. And interestingly, we're now seeing a replay of that as creditors are being asked, in some cases forced, to waive foreclosure on a variety of mortgages, including subprime mortgages. And these are not just mortgages that were fraudulently induced. If there's fraud in the inducement of the mortgage, there are already laws on the books to guard against it. Across the board, mortgages extended to home buyers who understood the risks involved, voluntarily assumed those risks, and are now being given the benefit of not having to meet their contractual obligations. Next case is about a clause that very few people even study in law school, and yet it's the very first sentence in the Constitution after the preamble. It says in the Constitution, all legislative power is vested in Congress. Now, the framers were pretty smart to say that. They knew that if Congress passes laws we don't like, we can vote the bums out of office, so the voters always had some redress. Well, suppose, however, Congress passes a law that nobody understands, and then they delegate the responsibility for fleshing out the details to one of the 319 regulatory agencies, the alphabet agencies and cabinet departments in Washington, D.C. Well, then the voters have no recourse because these agencies are not run by elected officials. They're run by unelected bureaucrats. The voters have no recourse, and apparently the courts are not going to do very much about it either. And if you like this principle of delegation of legislative power, even though the Constitution forbids it, then you will love TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which turned U.S. lawmaking power over to Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary. First, Paulson decided, without any congressional guidance, to purchase toxic assets from banks that were too big to fail. Within a few weeks, he changed his mind, again without congressional guidance, and TARP morphed into a direct injection of capital into these same institutions. And then, of course, his successor, Timothy Geithner, came along, and the program changed again to provide for a public-private partnership by which Geithner meant that private banks would get all the money and the public, namely the taxpayers, would put up all the money. Along the way, of course, the administration expropriated $180 billion to bail out AIG, the giant insurance company, and tens of billions of dollars to bail out the automobile companies, despite Congress's refusal, express refusal, to pass legislation supporting an automobile bailout. And what have the courts said about all of this? Well, the courts have said, yes, we understand the Constitution says that Congress can't delegate its legislative power. We know that's what's in the document, but after all, governing is a complex business, and we're going to have to permit this kind of delegation, but we will allow for one requirement, and that is Congress, in delegating its power, has to establish what's called an intelligible principle. So the people in the agencies, they know how to flesh out the details, how to conform the details of these regulations that they passed to reflect the intent of Congress. Well, what is the intelligible principle that Henry Paulson and Timothy Geithner had to follow? Nobody knows. Least of all, the taxpayers who have to foot the bill. Make things better is not an intelligible principle. Finally, there are lots of cases I could go on for hours, but finally, because we have a short on time, I want to mention the campaign finance law. The case involved, there was a 2003 case, which was the law of the land until a couple weeks ago, and that is McConnell versus Federal Election Commission. Campaign finance reformers had this quixotic notion that money and elections should not mix. And so they passed the McCain-Feingold law in 2002. We see how well that worked in the 2008 election. 6 years after that law was enacted, more money was spent in the 2008 election than in any election in the history of the universe. Now, McCain-Feingold ultimately became the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and the Supreme Court, I think inexplicably, upheld that act in the McConnell case in 2003. The court decided in the McConnell case, in upholding McCain-Feingold, that political speech, the most fundamental form of free speech that we can exercise in this country, political speech would be entitled to less protection than Klan speech, than pornography, than flag burning. Every one of those is protected under the First Amendment, but believe it or not, under McCain-Feingold, if a corporation, like, let's say, Random House, were to publish a book, and the book had the words anywhere in its text, "Vote for Obama," the entire book could be banned under McCain-Feingold because it was published by a corporation and had express advocacy, vote for or against an individually named candidate. Of course, we're not supposed to be into banning books in America. And that's why the court took on a follow-up case just a few weeks ago called Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission. Happily, January, just last month, the court overturned McCain-Feingold's two worst restrictions on corporate and union political expression. The first of which was that no publication could expressly say, vote for or against an identified candidate. And the second of which was even more egregious, no broadcast ad, television, radio, cable, internet, no broadcast ad could even name a candidate within 60 days of an election or 30 days of a primary, even if it said nothing about voting for or against. The case involved, Citizens United versus FEC, Hillary the movie. Hillary the movie was very critical of Hillary Clinton, and they sought to distribute that movie. Distributing it in the theaters was okay. Distributing it on DVD was okay. But to run a television ad telling people to go to the theaters was not okay. And trying to distribute the movie cable on demand was not okay, because it named a candidate, Hillary Clinton, and it was done within 60 days of an election or 30 days of a primary. The court, the Supreme Court, to its great credit, recognized that corporations and unions don't need to be restricted. They have countervailing power. Corporations and unions do not speak with one voice. Corporations will often favor policies that unions oppose. Walmart may even favor health care, while Whole Foods may not favor health care. Individuals should be free to associate and pool their resources and express themselves as they wish, whether individually, through a union, through a corporation, a partnership, an LLC, or even a club. And under the new rules, it's important to note that corporations and unions still may not contribute directly to candidates, and they still have to disclose if they pay for an ad, so we'll all know who's footing the bill. But the ad itself, if it's independent, if it's not coordinated with the candidate, can be broadcast without restriction. Now, there is an answer to too much money. The answer is overweening government has wormed its way into nearly every aspect of our lives, our pervasive regulatory system, our redistributive system, creates huge incentives for special interests to seek favors from politicians. So there's a big money problem, but only because there's a big government problem. If we were to cut government down to size, we could minimize the influence of big money, restoring the framers' notion of enumerated, delegated, and liberal, and limited federal powers will get government out of our lives, out of our wallets. That's the best way to end this campaign finance racket and root out corruption without jeopardizing political speech. In a free society, we shouldn't have to ask for government permission to participate in an election, and we shouldn't be forced to buy health insurance or to bail out failed car companies. Those abuses of government power can be minimized, but only if the court ensures that the legislative and the executive branches are bound by the chains of the Constitution. And I think, regrettably, the Supreme Court has occasionally been derelict in fulfilling that obligation, and it is time to restore constitutional government. Thanks very much.
Dr. Levy. Dr. Levy, thank you for being with us today, and thanks for those insightful remarks. And we have a couple reminders of your visit with us today that I'd like to present you. First of all, Marco Island, Culture and History, a book on Marco, and Naples, Florida. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to call on Bob to handle the questions that you've presented.
And you got some good ones. And Bob, we're going to start off with some cities take property from citizens to make large building complexes to increase the tax revenue. What does the Constitution interpret this action? What are your views?
Two separate questions. What does the Constitution say about it, and what does the Supreme Court say about it? You may recall a few years ago a case called Kelo versus City of New London. And the issue in the Kelo case was whether Mrs. Kelo, who loved and cherished her home, a private home that she'd lived in for many years, could be forced off her property. Why? Because a private developer went to the city council and said, look, I know how to use that property better than Mrs. Kelo knows how to use it. I can convince Pfizer to come in and build a pharmaceutical plant, and we can put up a hotel and some office buildings. And bear in mind that there's going to be an increase in the tax base, and that's going to be good for the community, and will create some jobs. And they asked Mrs. Kelo about this, and she said, no go, she wants to stay there. And she pointed to the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, where it says, you can take private property, but only for public use. That's what the Constitution says. Those are the exact words, public use. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, ordinarily we mean roads, military bases, public office buildings. And the Supreme Court took a look and said, yeah, we know the Constitution says public use, but we really didn't mean that. We meant public purpose, public benefit, anything that will redound to the benefit of the public and serves a useful public purpose, and certainly expanding jobs and providing for a higher tax base that serves to satisfy the Constitution. And so they did take Mrs. Kelo's home away from her. Of course, if this is the standard, public purpose, nobody's home is safe from the government bulldozer, because your home and will never generate the kind of tax base that a pharmaceutical plant will, or a hotel, or a commercial office building. Now, by the way, there's an epilogue, and that is that several years now after the Kelo case, the firm that litigated the case, the Institute for Justice, and I'm happy to serve on their board of directors, took this case to a second venue. They lost in court. They took it to the court of public opinion through the media. And the major campaign, media crusade, resulted in 43 states passing legislation that effectively trumped the implications of the Kelo case. And there are two lessons there, by the way. One is that there's more than one venue to win a case. You can lose in court, and you can still succeed in getting legislation passed that will trump the court's decision. The second is that the federal Constitution provides a floor, not a ceiling. It specifies what rights you're entitled to, but if the states want to come in and give you more rights, more property rights, the states can do so. And so the aftermath of the Kelo case is quite good. The decision itself was horrible.
Thank you, Bob. Cato favors making marijuana legal. Isn't it addictive? Isn't it a gateway drug?
Well, tobacco is reported to kill 400,000 people a year, and it is legal. It's taxed, it's regulated, but it's legal. Marijuana, to my knowledge, kills nobody, and yet it is illegal. And as we make it illegal, we generate enormous black market profits, which end up funding Hamas, Hezbollah, and even Al-Qaeda. Beyond that, the libertarian view is that this is a matter of personal choice. As Jefferson put it in the Declaration of Independence, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And he meant by that the purpose of government is to secure rights, to prevent people from harming other people. And so the threshold question is whose rights are being harmed when an individual on his own agrees to and wants to smoke marijuana. As long as innocent third parties are not being affected, there should be, in the libertarian view, no role for the U.S., for the government, federal or state.
Will you comment on restricting civil liberties versus engaging police powers during times of war?
The Cato Institute was vigorous in our criticism of the Bush administration for focusing too much power in the executive branch of government. A lot of the things the Bush administration did might have been justifiable. That's a separate question. Something may be justifiable and still be unconstitutional.
And when you get those two things merged,
are we on? When you get those two things combined, namely a justifiable policy that's unconstitutional, you have to do one of two things. You either have to change the policy so it conforms with the Constitution, or you have to change the Constitution so that it justifies the policy. The one thing you cannot do is treat the Constitution as if it's so much tissue paper, because that breeds disrespect for the law and for a document that has preserved our freedoms for a couple of centuries. And it was our view that that's what the Bush administration did with warrantless wiretaps, with detention of U.S. citizens without charges for indefinite periods of time with no access to an attorney, with vigorous interrogation techniques that may have violated our treaty obligations, with secret camps maintained by the CIA and perhaps other organizations that Americans were unaware of. Again, as a policy matter, some of these things may have been justified. As a procedural matter, they should, at a minimum, have been congressionally authorized. Most particularly military tribunals. Now, we have said, just to bring this up to date, in the current context of whether or not KSM and the underwear bomber should be tried in federal court, we have said they should be tried in a military tribunal because there are costs and inconvenience to the city of New York or wherever the case might be tried. There's the risk of disclosing classified information. There is more restrictive interrogation under the federal laws. And most importantly, and this gets back to my initial remark, most importantly, there is now a legitimate alternative available, military commissions. They were not available when Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, was tried. They were not available when Massawi, the 11th hijacker, was tried. But now, as a result of the Supreme Court's intervention, the Military Commissions Act was passed in September of 2006, and so it's perfectly appropriate to try KSM and the underwear guy in the context of a military commission.
Thank you, Bob. Please discuss the libertarian view of abortion.
This is a difficult question, and it boils down to two questions. The first threshold question is, when does life begin? The second question is, who gets to decide the first question? So on the first question, when does life begin, this, of course, is a matter about which scientists and theologians and philosophers have disagreed, and the Supreme Court was smart enough to understand that. And Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun, who wrote the Roe v. Wade opinion in 1973, he said, this is not an exact quote, but it's pretty close, he said, when in this stage of our process, the scientists and the theologians and the philosophers cannot decide when life begins, far be it from the nine members of this court to venture forth and make that determination. And, of course, having said that, he then proceeded to do exactly what he said the court should not do and lit upon this trimester scheme, which was later modified in the 1992 case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, to become a pre-viability versus post-viability scheme. The libertarian view, and bear in mind now that I can't speak for every libertarian. I can speak for the scholars at the Cato Institute. Our view is the Supreme Court should never have ventured into that area. That's quite separate from whether you are pro-choice or pro-life. I personally am pro-choice, but I believe Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. It was wrongly decided because there are no objective legal standards by which nine judges can make a determination of when it is that that life begins. That matter should have been left up to state legislatures. If I were a state legislature, I might have voted for something very similar to what came down as a result of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood. But it was not up to the courts to do that. It was up to the legislature.
Last question. Was Judge Alito right?
Well, you heard my views about the campaign finance case. I think on the merits of the case, the Supreme Court got it right, and President Obama got it wrong. Not only did he get it wrong on the underlying merits, he even got it wrong on the details, because he said, for example, that foreign corporations could now control our elections. That simply is not the case. Foreign corporations cannot contribute money to candidates. They cannot expend money for advertising. The only exception to that is a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign corporation, which can spend for advertising but cannot contribute to a candidate, and only to the extent of the profits that that corporation earns. Now, as a matter of propriety, I think the president was wrong as well. He had a captive audience. The Supreme Court justices were there by invitation. They had no means by which to respond to the allegations that the case was wrongly decided. I think it was inappropriate for the president to use that particular form. He certainly is free to criticize the Supreme Court, but in that particular form, I think it was inappropriate. And so Alito's response, I think, was natural and correct as well.
Bob's book is available after the...
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Dr. Levy. Next meeting, February 19th. Look forward to seeing you then. We are adjourned.